I'd like to talk about the evolution of development, which is now a slightly more complex issue, because now we are dealing with multicellular organisms. So we have additional levels of biological organization. So if we think about evolution, we have to remember that the basis of evolutionary change is obviously variations in the DNA, genotypic variations. And the whole issue I want to address here is how and whether these genotypic variations are translated into phenotypic variations, be it in the final adult form or during development, in developmental processes. So in a multicellular organism, can you hear me okay? Or? I don't know if I can put it higher. So in a multicellular organisms, this relationship between genotype and phenotype goes through several layers of organization, but it also goes through the temporal unfolding of development from embryo to adult. So the relationship is not straightforward at all. If you represent very simplistically a genotype and phenotype as two-dimensional maps, you may have instances where you have one genotype which gives you a given phenotype. But in most cases, the relationship is much more complicated. So you might have one genotype which gives you a range of phenotype. And in this case, one might speak about, so depending whether you're a biologist, a physicist, a chemist, or whatever, you call it what you want. To me, it's about the same. But you can say that this system here is not robust to noise. For example, in the environment, you might have two different environmental conditions during development, which gives rise to two different phenotypes. And in the extreme, you might have like two castes of ants. So you have completely discrete phenotypes, which are obtained with the same genotype. You might also have what we could call internal noise, which is internal in environmental noise, which gives you, for a given clone, different phenotypic outputs.
So in you're distinguishing noise which is regulated in some way versus it's just there?
No, I'm not. In this case, an environment, it can be noise, but it can be also very regulated.
Okay.
In
so
some, I mean, no, I don't
so
want
what's
to.
The difference between robust and buffer?
To me, there isn't. But
huh?
To me, there isn't. I tend to use any of these three words, depending on the audience, actually. And in the reverse situation, you might have a range of genotypes which give rise to a single phenotype, at least in the space we are speaking about. In this case, you can say that the system is robust to genetic variations. So many genotypes can give rise to a single phenotype. Okay. And the questions we may ask in evolution of development is how stable, I mean, in development first and in evolution of development second, is how stable are developmental processes when they are faced with variations, either internal noise during development or environmental variations or genetic variations. And this is a question which is not very often asked by developmental biologists. Then, in terms of evolution, what is the actual nature of the genotypic changes that modify developmental processes? Are they changes, you know, whole genome duplication? Are they single point mutations? Do they affect coding sequences, regulatory sequences? What type of proteins, metabolic proteins, regulatory transcription factors, and so on? And most importantly, for me at least, is how do these changes propagate from the genotypic level to the phenotypic level through the hierarchy of biological organization? And that's where we come to the notion of modularity. So I try to center my talk on this, even though I don't think about these things every day. But if you very schematically say that biological organization is, you know, goes from one DNA base, which might be a substrate of evolution, a nucleotide, a molecule, a cell, and an organism. And actually, if there is a module, to me, my favorite module would be the cell. It is a module. In between all these levels, there is also some modularity in the sense that you have some more connect, I mean, that's how I would define it, more connected, for example, molecular networks within a cell or cellular networks within a building organism. So this modularity will help describing morphological organization. I mean, even in an adult, you know, it makes sense to describe an arm or a leg as being modules or a liver or something. It also helps to describe development, as we will see. And we'll try to see whether there are some relationship between final product and development. And the second questions, which I think we should keep separated in mind, is how do these developmental or morphological modules behave during evolution? So this is the plan for my talk, if I get to all this. First, I'd like to talk about the modular organization of development itself, first looking at modules above the cell level, and then very shortly at modules of interacting molecules, but that, for example, Nama talked about yesterday. And then what happens during evolution? And if I have time, and I probably won't, I will tell you more about what we do in the lab, which is working on nematode vulva evolution. So the most examples I'm going to take are from the nematodes, because that's what I know best. C. elegans has the great advantage, as you probably know, to have a fixed number of cells. So the adult hermaphrodite has 959 somatic cells, which are all we know for each of them where they come from in the cell division pattern of the animal during development. So they have names. They are the same in every individual of the species. So it's a great tool to study development or any neurobiology, for example. So it's a self-fertilizing hermaphrodite. The hermaphrodite produces sperm and is self-fertile. But there are also males, which allows matings, at least in the lab, and maybe also in nature. I mean, we don't know whether males mate in nature. And one point I want to make is, okay, it appears that C. elegans has a weird development because of this invariance of cell lineage. But actually, it makes use of the exact same cell specification mechanisms that other animals or plants use, which are you can make two cells different by an asymmetric division. And you can make two cells different because one of them is going to receive a signal. I mean, these are the two basic modes of cell specification during development, and both are extensively used in C. elegans. Yes, in this case, yes.
Before they divide, so they will polarize the...
So not in every case. So there are cases where it's like this. They are polarized, and they divide and give rise to two different cells. But there are many instances in C. elegans, and that wasn't recognized at first because of this. That was the mystics about this cell lineage, which was invariant. Actually, I will give you a lot of examples where the two cells, let's say this might be two sister cells, they were exactly identical at the beginning, and because one of them received a signal, it became different.
In the other cases also where the which way they divide is stochastic, or is that polarized earlier by some signal?
They are polarized earlier by some signal in in most cases. Yes, I give this example. Sorry?
Yeah.
Well, I'll talk about the, I mean, that's one big part of my talk. So.
Could you explain again why segregation makes them asymmetric if they inherit the same set of genes?
They inherit the same set of genes, but most of development is not about, it's about gene regulation, gene expression. The regulation of gene expression. So they might inherit different sets of messenger RNA or, for example, yes, or proteins, which might then in turn regulate expression differently in the two cells. Because in every case, this is actually the first mitosis. So you get two different cells by an asymmetric division. And then this cell, again, is going to divide asymmetrically and so on. But this cell is going to divide symmetrically, and there will be a lot of inductive signaling. And after a while, you get an embryo with 12, 20 cells, and every single cell has a different environment and different neighbors. So every cell becomes different. It's very easy to get small symmetric breakages in the embryo. But because the cell contacts are all reproducible, you always get the same output, even though, you know, it can regulate if you remove a cell. Yeah, that's what's written here, basically, that you have both this asymmetric cell division and cell interaction. And the fact that the cell lineage is invariant just comes from the fact that all happens with a limited number of cells and with a precise cleavage patterns, which make cell interactions being reproducible or almost completely reproducible. So here, what I just described to you is a cellular level of description of development, which is very appropriate in C. elegans. But even in C. elegans, can we use this a slightly more supracellular level of description to describe C. elegans development or morphology? And from morphology, we can think, you know, of the pharynx or some the nervous system as being a tissue which is more than one cell. During development, can we say that cells are specified together and not one by one, as was first assumed looking at the lineage? So what I'm talking about here, it's modularity above the cell level, either in the final result, so tissue or body part, or in the building process, the mechanism of development. And I'll give examples of that. And it doesn't mean, for example, the pharynx is a final structure which we can describe as some, you know, module in a physiological sense, but it's actually not built by one mechanism. The pharynx is an assembly of very different cells which come from different parts and are specified differently. So this, there is no direct correspondence here between the two. So there are cases where you have a modular specification by what I would call lineage, whereby one precursor cell, for example, the E cell, which is a cell which arises very early in the embryo at the, you know, 6-8 cell stage, like this. And this cell, it's very easy. It just gives rise to intestinal cells. So it does express certain transcription factors which specify it as a precursor for intestinal cells. Then it will divide, give rise to 16, 20, what, I don't know, many cells of the intestine. There will be some differences between the anterior and posterior of the intestine. But overall, I would call this a module in development. It's also true for the germline, which comes from a very early precursor, so a single precursor. There is another modular specification that one can think of is when one cell is actually inducing a group of cells, and that's also very common in more complex, I mean, organisms with more cells. And here I've taken an example from the uterus development, where you have ventral uterine precursor cells, these three cells, which divide twice, and they give rise to two cell types, which are called rho or pi. And if you look at the cell lineage, it doesn't make sense at all. I mean, you wonder why these cells give two of each, one, three, three, one, whatever. If you look at the geometry, not only at this nice lineage diagram, it makes sense that all the pi cells are actually the ones which are around a specialized cell of the uterus, which is called the anchor cell. And it was shown by ablation and then by genetics that actually this anchor cell induces its neighbors to this specific pi fate. I mean, it doesn't matter what they are. The only message I want to convey here is that at the same time, through this cell interaction, you have these six cells being specified all together as a module.
If you put one of the, is it known that if you have other cells which are not one of these Z1, PPA, yeah, yeah, four, and so on, where this AC will also induce those to become?
No, you need to be competent. No, you need to be competent. I mean, that's a general thing in developmental biology.
So it's only these three that are competent. Yeah. And how far back do these have a common?
One of them is the sister of the anchor cell, and the two others are sisters. And back, they are very far back than the two pairs. So I've given you two cases where you can find during the development a modular specification. But what I find, I mean, what is also very common in C. elegans and probably in other organisms is cases where you have non-modular specification. There are many examples of this. I just told you, for example, the pharynx comes from two different, that it's a unique organ at the end, but it comes from two different parts. One part is specified by cell interaction and one part is not. Another example here, which is a domain of expression of a HOX gene. So MAP5 is one of these genes which is expressed along the anteroposterior axis of the animal. And so this is a worm with the head and the tail. MAP5 is expressed in the posterior region of the worm. And all the cells which express MAP5 are located at the end, more or less in the same region. You could say, okay, maybe they're all related by lineage. That's wrong. We know it from the lineage. So there is no modular specification by lineage. You could say, okay, they're all in the same region. There might be, you know, some cell inducing them all to express this transcription factor. And that's wrong. And that's, for example, explained by this experiment from Cynthia Kenyon's lab. One of these cells is the M cell. And this M cell actually is born in the embryo very anterior. And normally, it migrates posteriorly and starts expressing MAP5. If you block the migration of M, it stays anterior, but it does express MAP5, showing that it's not its position which makes it express MAP5. Hence, that it's not specified by a common position, by a common inducer in the posterior region. They did other experiments showing that V6 has a similar, I mean, it's a similar story. You could have other V6 which are located anterior and would still express MAP5. So in this case, this group of cells expressing MAP5 is actually not specified as a group. Each cell has a specific history. No, what would be needed now is to look at the cis-regulatory region of MAP5. But yes, I mean, that definitely. You might, I mean, sometimes cis-regulatory regions are amazingly complicated, and you might have one region for each cell. It's true that there are not so many cells here. You know, there might be 10 or 20. You might have some regions specific for each of them. It's not inconceivable in this case. Yes, exactly. So just to summarize what I just told you, you can have cell groups which are specified in a modular fashion by a shared lineage, like the intestine, or by shared cell interactions. And I gave you an example in the uterus of the pi versus rho. I'll give you later other examples. I mean, to me, this is what we mostly work on, are some kind of independent cell interaction networks, which are modules per se. what I show you is just one induction, the anchor cell inducing cell type. You can also have networks of cell interactions with feedbacks and more elaborate. And this might often be used in the development of coherent final structures. And a very good example is the vertebrate limb bud or the insect imaginary discs. And we also have this non-modular development, which you can call by piecemeal recruitment of different cells for a given tissue or a given, you know, expression pattern. And I particularly like, in one of the old papers by John Sulston, I think the first lineage paper, he actually called this perverse assignments, because when you look in the lineage, you really find, you know, that body muscle is going to come from there and there and there and there in the lineage without any, it doesn't make sense at all from the engineering type, I mean, for the human mind. Okay, now I'm going to go down in the hierarchy of organization and tell you just a little bit about modules of interacting molecules. Obviously, these cells interacting do so by using molecular signals. And I'm going to give here a very simple example, which is, again, the MAP kinase cascade that we heard about yesterday. This cascade is used in many instances in C. elegans. For instance, in the induction of the vulva, I will tell you more about later. So you have a signal and a receptor. That's the minimal module of two molecules interacting. But then you have a signal transduction cascade downstream, which is extremely conserved. It's conserved in the worm because it's used in different tissue, in the vulva and in the male tail. It's also conserved. Okay, yeast doesn't have tyrosine kinase receptors like this, but this part at least is conserved in yeast. But, you know, you can call this a module if you like, but there are also two submodules here, since you can also have the same receptor and ligands, but inducing another pathway within the cell. Or conversely, the FGF receptor instead of the EGF receptor, using the same downstream cascade in another case in C. elegans. So the 2 points here is that you reuse the same molecular pathways during development. And they can be, I mean, the notion of modules here is a little fuzzy. I mean, there are submodules. You can also have more complex modules than this. So during evolution, as I told you, you can have this same cascade for vulva development in C. elegans and for eye development in the fly. So there is a very strong, I mean, this was a big findings, I would say, over the last 20 years in evolution of development, is that basically, you know, 30, 40 years ago, we found that we have the same metabolism as bacteria, we have the same, you know, way of replicating DNA and so on. But it became clear in the last 10 or 15 years that you also have during development the same, in animals, the same molecules which are used for all animals. So you have the same transcription factors, and that's the spectacular, you know, the things which come as a covers of whatever. You have the HOX genes, which pattern the AP axis of all animals. You have maybe PAX6, which is so important in eye development, and so on and so on. You have transcription factors, which are signatures of different tissues. You also have signal transduction cascades. There are not so many of them, you know, might be 6 or 8 of them, which are used and reused. And because it's obvious that the vulva, the C. elegans vulva and the fly eye are not homologous structures, it doesn't make sense to compare in development this, I mean, the use of these cascades in these two organs. I'm saying this because, you know, in the evolution of development community, this this doesn't seem obvious. especially for transcription factors. So the approach we took was actually to decide to go not at a too large evolutionary scale, but to study the development of structures that we knew were homologous, and for example, the vulva within nematodes. So just for fun, I mean, nematodes, C. elegans lives in the soil from bacteria and other microorganisms, and you can isolate other species, there are millions of them which are not described, from the soil, and you culture them in the lab on petri dishes, and you feed them with E. coli. So we have tons of different species, most of them being undescribed, actually. And like C. elegans, at least these nematodes have an invariant lineage. We can do laser ablations, we can do genetics with them, and so on. The advantage of nematodes as a tool for evolution of development is that not only can we be quite sure that the vulva is an homolog organ throughout the nematodes, but also the cells, the precursor cells to the vulva, can be found in all the nematodes we study. And this is a great tool because we, you know, we start with the same cells in all nematodes, and we can study the differences in their development between different nematode species. So now I'm going.
In some stage back up in the lineage where the cells are the same in the tube, but not all the way down the lineage. I'm not sure when you said that the same cells are in the.
I don't know where these cells come from in another species, to tell you the truth.
Okay, from that stage on.
Yes, exactly. There might be difference in embryonic development.
Do you mean the same between one species and another species, or do you mean the same between different individuals?
No, I mean the same between one species and another species.
They are the same. I mean, at hatching, so you have an embryonic development, and then you have four larval stages and the adults. At hatching from the embryonic stage, you can find in all the nematodes we study these 12 T cells, which are very easy to find. Yeah. Now, I don't know where they come from in the embryonic lineage.
From them.
Yeah. The embryonic lineage of Panagrellus is not known. So now, coming to the evolutionary part, what I'm going first to tell you about the evolution of some of these modules, supracellular modules of interactions between cells. And mostly, I'm going to talk about this anchor cell VU stochastic decision. So this is actually work I did a while back when I was a postdoc with Paul Sternberg at Caltech. So there are a few examples where the lineage is not invariant. And one of them is lineage of the somatic gonad. So the somatic gonad comes from two precursors. It develops in the first larval stage. That Z1 and Z4 are two precursor cells. Basically, Z1 will give rise to the anterior ovary arm and Z4 to the posterior ovary arm. But in the middle, there is a single cell which will become the anchor cell, so the specialized cell of the uterus which sends signal I told you about before to distinguish pi versus rho. It also sends signal to make the vulva. So you have absolutely equivalent Z1 and Z4 here, but you need a single anchor cell. So the way it's done is that actually over the population, so just to remind you, these animals are self-fertilizing hermaphrodites, and the reference strain that everybody uses in the lab, called N2, is a clone. So all the animals are identical genetically. But in these populations, you get in 50% of the individuals, the anchor cell is actually the cell coming from Z1. So we give them horrible names just to say where they come from. So it's the posterior daughter of the posterior daughter of the posterior daughter. And in 50% of the animals, it's the other cell. And then the other one becomes a ventral uterine precursor. That's why in all cases, you had three ventral uterine precursors. So this is one of the few cases where the lineage is not invariant. I mean, it's still, you only have two cells which can become the anchor cell. It's not all over the place. And this has been worked out by Judith Kimball and then Iva Greenwald's lab. It's a very nice system. I think it's maybe one of the simplest, you know, multicellular module of development. You have two cells, which are identical at the beginning, and which will give rise to two different cell types. And the way we think now that this occurs is through so you have a receptor and a ligand called Notch and Delta. These are the Seligman's names, but let's call them Notch and Delta. So Notch is the receptor, Delta is the ligands. And initially, both cells express the ligands and the receptors. Then you have inbuilt feedback loops, which make, so I represented the receptor like this, the ligands like an arrow. So if the receptor is activated, it will, on one end, positively activate its transcription, and it will inhibit the transcription of the ligands. And you can easily see that this system is metastable. I mean, you cannot stay in this situation. A small fluctuation is going to sweep the system in one or the other direction. So you might end up with one cell actually expressing the ligand and becoming the anchor cell, and the other the receptor, or the contrary. So over the population, you have a random outcome.
Yeah, okay. I just say that it's terribly important to look at the widely used in brain development.
In
the Notch Delta system, unbelievably widely used.
Also, where there's a ends up being a precision objective.
But as far as I know, it's the only.
The development of the nervous system. I just want to emphasize how important.
It might be.
It's where you've got a group of cells where the one decides to become the neuron and the other one decides not to become the neuron. If it decides to become the neuron, then it inhibits its labor from the computer.
You might have a group of cells, basically.
If
you might have a group of cells like this, which are all competent, and one of them is going to express the ligand, basically, and inhibit the others. That's. We can, so what we can do is with a laser ablate one of them, and the other one always becomes the anchor cell. Well, you will get less ventral uterine tissue, but nothing really bad will happen. No. I mean, in the lab, in nature, yeah. And having two anchor cells is bad because you have problems with going back. But having no anchor cell is a disaster, because then.
But it's always on the left side or the right side, it doesn't matter.
Well, in C. elegans, that never happens. Yeah, I will show you in other species, but in C. elegans, it's always 50-50.
You can make it happen by the overexpressed, say, the receptor. If you took the balance, then.
You could, this hasn't been done, but you could, in principle, say, this has been done with genetic mosaics, so that you, in a mutant for the receptor, you only express it in the Z1 or the C4 lineage. And then, then the cell which expresses the receptor becomes the VU and the other one the anchor cell. No.
But it's true that in like the you don't get.
Wait a second. Yeah. Okay, wait here. So, actually, yeah, at the beginning I was interested in the fact that many nematodes, instead of having these two symmetric ovary, like C. elegans, so this is anterior ovary, this is the uterus in yellow, the posterior ovary. And Z1 and Z4 are completely equivalent, so you need a symmetry breakage here, downstream of Z1 and Z4. In other nematodes, you have a reduction of the posterior arm. Mostly in the nematodes I studied, it was always the posterior arm. And in this case, you might get a bias. So for example, in this species, which is a recent evolutionary event, actually, of reduction of the posterior arm, you get 95% of the animals, which get Z4 AAA, so the D4 descendant becoming the anchor cell. And the same here. You can get even more extreme in this other family here, where it's always completely fixed. So here you get to an invariant lineage. You don't have the same story as Schiedegans. It's completely fixed. No. No, unfortunately.
Can you, in C-elegant, exchange equivalent cells from Z1 to Z4 and have the outcome be the same? Are the Z1 and Z4 lineages completely symmetric in that sense?
We cannot manipulate the cells so as to exchange the position, unfortunately.
Yes, it would be.
Actually, I don't know. I'm not completely sure, because the two arms actually navigate in different environments, because one navigates anteriorly on the right and the other one posteriorly on the left. And I'm not sure that all this turning and stuff would be equivalent. And you can also get, this is another, I didn't put a phylogenetic tree, but this is another instances of reduction of the posterior arm. Actually, it's so reduced it doesn't exist at all. The anchor cell is the most posterior cell. In this case, it's fixed on the Z1 lineage. So in different evolutionary lines, you get a bias of fixation towards one of them, in Z4 or Z1. And furthermore, well, no, you have many other species which have two arms like C. elegans, where it's like C. elegans. I can tell you a lot about the chance that Brenner had choosing C. elegans, but for many, many reasons. But anyway, so now just coming back to this, if we just take the species here with a bias or fixation towards Z4, we can ask what are the mechanisms. So unfortunately, we don't know at the molecular level, and the reason is that we never managed to do transformation in these other species. That's why I say Brenner was lucky. So in C. elegans, you have a half-half, so represented, you know, orange is anchor cell and yellow ventral uterus, half-half chance for each, and you have a symmetric lateral interaction between the two, or lateral inhibition. You have cases where it's always Z4 AA, which becomes the anchor cell. But if you remove it with a laser, this one is going to replace it. So it means that you have a unilateral interaction here, an induction of the VU fate, of the ventral uterine fate here. So you change from a symmetric system here to a completely unilateral, to an induction. You have, in the biased case, if you do the ablation, you can replace. So it's like a biased lateral signaling. But you also have cases where if you ablate this cell, this one is not going to replace it. If you ablate this one is not going to replace it. So their development has become completely independent. And here, I think this is the simplest example you can think of, with just two cells. Of here having a nice developmental module, which is completely symmetric, which here has completely broken down in evolution. Okay?
That symmetric breaking comes from the membrane cell? There is some sequence from the membrane cell?
So, what I don't know the answer, but in all cases, where we have here an asymmetry, Z1 and Z4 actually are asymmetric from the beginning, for example, in the timing of the division or something. So I think the asymmetry here comes from the lineage, basically, from you know, the history in the division patterns beforehand. It could also come from a cell interactions from another cell. Yeah. That's
cool. So the cell autonomous case you mentioned at the end,
yes.
Is cell autonomous only at that point, and certainly what made those cells different to begin with is almost certainly a non-cell autonomous event, based on what we know from Belden's work. So the symmetry break for those two cells is different for earlier non-cell autonomous events that occurred.
We don't know. I mean, my point anyway is that they're autonomous from each other, but Z1 and Z4 could be different for cell autonomous reasons as well.
You're assuming that
I didn't put a phylogeny here because it's in some instances it's clearly yes. You know, it might be very complicated with reversal in several directions. There is one example, this Osiris Günther here is surrounded by all symmetric species. The whole genus is like this. And so in this case, this is the derived state. No, there are no strong cases, but the phylogeny is too bad, I would say. There is another example. I mean, this is not particular to nematodes at all. There is a very old classic example from Spemann's time of lens induction in frogs, where in one frog species, so Spemann had done the experiment of removing the tissue and having no induction, and then I forgot her name, but a woman had done the similar experiment in the next frog species and didn't find the same result. And Spemann came back to this species and found out that, sure enough, this lens in this case wasn't, I mean, there might have been an induction, but it wasn't required. There was a semi-autonomous process. So between two frog species, you also had differences like I see here. Other examples, very nice work from Jofan and Bigela and Pierre Guerrier on mollusks and annelid embryos, where they could see that the determination of the D micromere, so it's the cell which will become the mesoderm, basically, or the dorsal quadrant of the animal. In some species, it's determined by asymmetric cell division, and in some other species, it's determined by induction. And in this case, they did a very thorough phylogenetic analysis, and it seems that there is a direction from cell induction to going towards asymmetric division.
And just sort of generally, one would might think that going backwards would be harder to get back to something which is symmetric from something which is asymmetric.
Well, I always want, you know, there have been a lot of mutagenesis screening C. elegans for gonad shape, and you find a lot of mutants which affect the posterior ovary more than the anterior ovary, actually. But you never get a complete reduction. And I didn't talk about it, but basically the reduction is, in most cases, due to death of the cell which actually grows. To me, genetically, it seems that it would be very easy in a species where they're asymmetric to become symmetric again. I mean, the breakage of a symmetry in evolution seems more difficult to me, but it's hand waving. No?
Well, there are lots of cases in developmental genetics where you go from an asymmetry to a symmetry. For example, in the elements in another species, it's easy to break, it's easy to convert from asymmetry to symmetry by mutation.
Sure. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly my argument, yeah. Seems easier. But now we don't know the selection pressure behind, so that's in terms of speed of evolution. Okay, so basically the message I wanted to tell here was that we had a very nice developmental module with these two cells interacting, but in evolution, this is not a good, you know, description. And in most cases, we found intermediates. So in C. elegans, and you know, probably in the last Nobel Prize was about this, but that there are many, you know, more than 100 cells are born and die. And it seems that if you look in evolution of lineages in nematodes, but also in you know, in other animals, that the regulation of cell death is something which occurs very often. You could think that, you know, instead of making the cell being born and then making it die, you just suppress division. But it might be that it's much easier at the evolutionary level to regulate cell death.
But in that sense, the cell death is not loss of function, but it's a programmed cell death. So
yes.
Going back to symmetric
Yes, right. There are a few examples in C. elegans where this is true, and one of them is the equivalent cell of the anchor cell in the male, which is called the linker cell. And what the linker cell does is actually, so the male gonad has a completely different shape, but the linker cell will lead the elongation of the gonad towards the posterior end of the animal, and then dies once it's there. But if it's not there before, the gonad is not going. So it does occur that the cell may function. Well, no, this linker cell, you know, lives for several hours before dying. In 99% of the cases, the cells die at its birth. It's really, really very fast. So I doubt. Okay, on this subject, I'm not sure this slide is very clear, but what I want to say here is that unfortunately we don't know what are the molecular mechanisms in all these other species for the anchor cell specification. But what we can notice is if we take C. elegans or the fly or any other organism, this notch delta system is used in a wide range of cellular specification mechanisms. What I mean by this is that it's used in this purely symmetric lateral interaction for the anchor cell. But already talking about the linker cell in the male, in the C. elegans male, the linker cell is more likely to come from Z1 than from Z4. So here it's already biased, and we know it's also using the notch delta system. You also have cases, and that's one case in the vulva, but the other case was this anchor cell induced in the pie cells, where notch and delta are used as very conventional, you know, inductive signaling, where one cell, this cell induces the expresses the ligand, which activates receptor. This is within the same group, or that's with the pie system, where it's from an outside cell. And you also have cases, for instance, this is a case from the fly nervous system, where you have within a sublineage the use of differential activation of notch in two daughter cells by the regulation, by other regulators of asymmetric divisions. So the message here is that you can use these molecular pathways in very different cellular specification contexts. So it's well possible, although we have no data on that, that this anchor cell specification across the nematode species keep the same molecular pathways. But just the wiring, the connections, the dynamics of the pathways are different. And to me, it's also important, again, in face of a good part of the evolution of development community, when they think that they see the expression of the same molecules, the same mechanism is at play, not necessarily at all. No, if you have an induction versus a lateral inhibition, I wouldn't call this the same mechanism. The same cell level mechanism, I would say.
I have not understood the distinction. Doesn't matter.
You know, if you describe this as I haven't drawn it like this, but we know quite a lot, especially from fly and C. elegans genetics, what is the pathway of this feedback pathway, the regulation through the transcription factors. This network can be described in a purely symmetric conditions, but it can also be described with different initial conditions in a case where you have an induction. It's the same pathways, but using different initial conditions or slightly different feedback loops, which make the dynamics of the system completely different.
Right.
exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So I like to take the view that evolution has been lazy. Mm-hmm. That once it found clever ways of doing things, it used them again.
Yes.
Well, I'm just amazed how lazy evolution has been. I'm sorry, work on it. I mean, it does some clever things, but in terms of basic mechanism, and particularly the signaling molecule, it uses the same one again and again.
No, that's clear.
So actually, what really varies are the control regions of the gene. Yeah, I know, a little bit of protein. Basically, it's the control region.
And to continue on your question, I guess Gary Odell is going to come in 1 or 2 weeks, but they made this model of this system actually, and seeing that in different parameter space, you actually get different outputs. But in C. elegans, it's known that, for example, in the vulva, you don't have transcription or regulation. So the module is not exactly the same in the sense of you might have loops which disappear in some cell types.
Is there some correlation between the range of the symmetry, advanced symmetry, local symmetry, and there's some sense of dichotomy among these different ones?
Well,
what I'm asking is whether you have to go through this range of phenotype, you have to tune things gradually or from the element again.
We don't have enough data really to say. It's difficult to say. Except for this one event where it's a recent evolutionary event and it's biased. We do, but we don't have enough species to make a general. I don't like to present phylogeny with, you know, six species.
So how recent is the recent one?
Recent.
How recent?
Oh.
One of these.
I can't tell because the molecular clock, if anything exists like this, I mean, the molecular evolution is very fast in nematodes, so it's very difficult to give accurate numbers. It's a species within it's a single species within a genus. I don't know what you make of this. It might be 100 million years in terms of divergence if you take the same speed as mouse versus human, but I don't believe it's 100 million years. Excuse me? Yes, quite a lot. Yeah. Of nematodes, not so many in nematodes. No. It's actually duplicated in C. elegans, and that's a close duplication, but that's another story. Okay, so the take-home message here is that the conservation of molecules or molecular pathway does not imply conservation of the specification mechanism when you look at the cellular level. And actually, I mean, one great example is the Hox genes themselves, since we know that the pattern of expression, which is quite conserved across animals, is established. It's very different in different animals. You know, think of Drosophila, think of mouse, think of leech. You might have at the end a similar looking expression pattern, but the way this was established is completely different. Okay.
But there must be some change in our same
tune. Sure, obviously. So now I'd like to get to the next point, which is that this evolution of modules in the organisms is greatly facilitated by modularity now at the level of the gene organization. The problem here, which is probably quite obvious to everyone, is that since we saw that the same molecules, transcription factors, signal transduction pathways are used and reused 10 times in the same organism, if you're going to touch something in it, it's going to touch it 10 times in the animal. So that's problem of pleiotropy in genetics. So how can evolution occur in one of these developmental modules without affecting the rest of the organism? So basically, it's not because developmental modules are quite independent dynamically that they are independent of the others at the evolutionary level. Okay, because the DNA, for example, the notch expression pattern, the notch locus is a single locus for all tissues. And one answer, there are several answers to this, but one is obviously gene duplication with subfunctionalization that we talked about in the last talk. One other possibility, which is not, there are not many examples of this yet, but I think it hasn't been looked much at, is that the coding region itself is modular. It's modular in terms of having protein domains that, there are some examples where you have protein domains which are only used for one function in one cell and not in the other. But you have, and this is, for example, true in the, if you take the EGF receptor in the worm, so it's a transmembrane receptor for EGF. And inside the cell, it has, 10 tyrosines, which are phosphorylated. And the output of this phosphorylation is tissue-specific. So actually, you can have, here you have modularity in all these tyrosines. If you remove them, if you remove one of them, you're going to affect one given tissue, but not the others. So also at the level of the coding sequence, you might have a possibility of independence. And this is because the downstream signaling cascades are different in different tissues. And then the obvious thing, which you're probably aware of, is that there is a great modularity in the way a given molecule is expressed in different tissues. And that's work, I didn't make a nice drawing, but this is work mostly from Mike Levine or Eric Davidson, where they showed that some specific genes which have complicated expression pattern during development do so by having, if you have the coding sequence here, it might have one little piece of DNA which makes it expressed in tissue one at time one, and then here another piece in tissue two at time two, and so on. So because these pieces of DNA are independent from each other, they're also evolutionarily independent. So it's easy to change what happens in tissue one without affecting what happens in tissue two.
I would say that's a very important principle in the whole evolutionary development of biology.
The question is open to experimentalists like us to know how much of evolution of development is due to evolution of cis regulatory regions versus I think there is a lot of people think like you, but I would like to see more data. It's because of this modularity. It obviously seems to be, and also because non-coding regions are just a bigger target of mutation. This is likely to be a very important mechanism. Now, whether I think biology is. It's never 100% true. There will be also evolution of coding sequences.
But there are other situations
Exactly. Well, I mean, one nice example is from Sean Carroll's lab. I mean, Sean is one also proponent of thinking that all is this regulatory evolution, but they actually found an example switching, I think, an onychophoran and an arthropod Hox gene that the protein evolution was also important. And they could actually find the small, you know, amino acid region, which was important in defining the targets. Yes, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and that is
a systematic survey.
Exactly.
I would also like to know which came first, because often you have the, if you have a switching regulation, and then some switching the coding to your finer back. And if there's any way trying to understand the history enough.
Yeah, and that's where you need to go to more microevolutionary instances, I think, where you can see the history. Okay. Well, that's exactly what I just said. Okay, I just have a very short last part, which is very more speculative. I actually told you a lot about evolution of development without changes in morphology at the end. So I'll just talk a little bit about change in morphology. And to me, it doesn't make much of a difference. Also in the vulva, you will see later, we don't have a change really in morphology. In the anchor cell VU story, the output is always the same. And in evolution of development, obviously, one of the big issues is how come the body plan is so stable, or is thought to be so stable. And so you can, now thinking in terms of these modules, you can have, they can allow for a lot of morphological evolution and what you can call developmental innovation even, if you can use and reuse all these modules very easily independently of each other by evolution, for example, of the regulatory sequences. And one great example, from Sean Carroll's lab again, is the reuse of the module which is used to pattern the wing in insects, which is reused to pattern the eye spots of butterfly wings. So you have a nesting of the hedgehog cascade reused a second time in development in the wing pattern. You have another example I can give is my favorite transcription factor in evolution of development is distal less, which is expressed any place where you have an appendage or something which sticks out of the body in cases which are really not homologous. So it's not like, you know, you say PAX6 is expressed, it's an eye. In this case, it's obvious that the arms of a starfish or the our legs or arms are not homologous. But you probably distal less as downstream of it linked a wall module of effectors which help migration of tissue or something to help make an outgrowth. So it's the reuse of this module, you know, of distal less and its downstream genes which is used during evolution. And then you can have, I think this is not a very difficult task in evolution to diversify by symmetry breakage. And I gave you the example of this Z1 versus Z4 symmetry breakage. And an animal is not, you know, you have a lot of small asymmetries within the embryo which can be used. Z1 and Z4 are actually not at the same place in the embryo, so they might receive different signals. They also don't come from the same parents, so they can also be different. So as soon as you have an embryo which is slightly, you know, where you have a few dozens of cells, you have so many small asymmetries that diversification might not be a huge problem. Hence, innovation. And okay, this is facilitation of developmental innovation. Now, many people in developmental biology talk about body plans. So body plan, it's a circular argument. The body plan is, to me, is what defines a phylum. And a phylum is something which is born in, which appeared in the Precambrian and has the same body plan. People wonder why there are not new phyla which have appeared since the Precambrian, but basically all the animals which are very derived parasites, for example, and haven't actually conserved the body plan of their phylum are considered as just derived. But in effect, the body plan, I think, is not that constrained. Yeah, I mean, that's true. And what's amazing is that we always think about animals, but in plants, the body plan is absolutely not constrained. And this made, it's a completely different world, actually. And this might be due to the way the development is temporally controlled. In plants, you have, you can go up putting leaves and flowers all the time, whereas an embryo makes its development only once. I mean, it's temporally much more controlled. So I have this horrible scheme. I hate doing this kind of things. But just to try to summarize my talk, to give you an idea of how I see this hierarchical organization during evolution of development. So you have here, this is the DNA, with some modularity in the promoter region, in the regulatory sequences, and also in the coding region. So these are my tyrosines. Then you have supramolecular modules, which might be connecting molecules, which are very conserved. And I would say this conservation is historical. You know, once you've RAS and RAF interact, that won't change. It's basically blocked. And then you have this modules of cells. So here, for example, the SCVU module or this anchor cell inducing the uterus module. And this type of network seems to be extremely dynamical during evolution. And finally, you have a body plan which seems to be more constant in some way, which is built either in a modular fashion or by piecemeal recruitment. And if you look at rates of evolution, what's remarkable in evolution of development is how slow there seems to be evolution at the level of these modules of molecular pathways. But I believe that there is very fast evolution at the level of cell specification mechanisms and these networks of cell interacting. And the other question we just alluded to is, the consensus seems to be that there is fast evolution at the promoter level and slow in the coding region. And I think that's probably true, but we still need to assess the relative contribution of each and how this actually translates throughout this hierarchy. Okay, if I have a little time, I'll tell you a little about the vulva and what we're doing. Okay, so the vulva is the egg-laying organ of the hermaphrodite, or the female. It's also through the vulva that the male introduces sperm. So an hermaphrodite without a vulva lays much less eggs, so there must be a strong selection pressure to having a vulva. It's a connection between the uterus, where you have the embryos, and the outside. And it's formed in the ventral epithelium. It's formed during juvenile development by cells which are called PNP cells, with N varying between 1 and 12. And they're actually in C. elegans 6 cells, P3P to P8P, which express a Hox gene, LIN39, which makes them competent to adopt a vulval fate. Yes?
These are PNP cells, does that mean there's
DNA
between these cells?
Yes.
And they go somewhere else.
The PNA actually gives rise to, they divide and give rise to neurons. But we won't talk about that. Yeah. So here it's represented. So the worms actually go on the right or on the left. So very conveniently for us, the ventral side is always just on the side, and they're very easy to see. So in the L3 stage, these six cells actually acquire three different fates. There are two fates which actually will form the vulva, with two different fates within this vulval fate, the primary or central vulval fate adopted by P6P, and the secondary or outer vulval fate by 5 and 7. And these three cells don't make vulva tissue. They just divide once, and then they fuse to the epidermis of the animal, which is a huge syncytium.
So this is really a one-dimensional arrangement of cells?
Yes.
And at this stage, how many cells are, say, around the...
The embryo it hatches with 550 cells, so at this stage there might be 650 it doesn't matter. I mean, but again, there is quite an independence, I think.
So these A cells are also on the surface?
They're tiny, actually, because they've become neurons. And I mean, they're tiny, they have big connection.
Just one of each of these cells, or there are several of them? These P3,
just one.
Just one of each,
one. It's a little more complicated than the ACVU, but basically, Paul Sternberg, so my... used to say I've devoted my life to seven cells, but that's about, it's more than two, but it's... and the way this pattern is achieved in C. elegans is thought to be a combination of two mechanisms. One, which is an induction from the anchor cell, so again, these cells from the ventral uterus, which induces at high doses of EGF, so the signal it sends, it induces the primary fate, and at low doses, it's able to induce a secondary fate. And in the absence of the anchor cell, you get only tertiary fate. And you have lateral interactions, again, through this notch pathway, whereby the cell receiving the most signal at the same time inhibits the primary fate and activates the secondary fate. Yeah.
So the are expressions of some
yes, genes. Of now they're expression of some genes. Historically, what people were doing was to look at the division pattern that they will adopt later and deduce from that. Now it's much getting easier with GFP reporters. Yes. So this in itself is an interesting system, and it's so you can also modelize this as a network of interacting molecules, and we've been playing with Eli Meyer from Gary Odell's lab to look in that system. So I guess Gary will talk about how they do, but the idea is to take all the connections between molecules that are known. And because we cannot measure parameters of affinities or decay of proteins, they just pick in a huge parameter space of a three log any random parameter and say whether you can obtain this pattern knowing the connections. And actually, this was amazingly robust in the system.
Is there any problem?
No, not for the vulva.
No,
it was just a... One of his ex-students came to my lab last spring, and we just played with them. Well, we hope to do more about this. But OK, and finally, what happened is that you get a vulval. These cells invaginate, link with the uterus, and they fuse to each other, and basically you have a hole for egg laying. OK. Just because I haven't showed you yet how it looks like in the microscope, here, what you see are the nuclei of each of the cell with the nucleolus inside. And this is one cell. So that's what we can look at by Nomaski microscopy. OK, so the developmental problem here is how do you form this pattern? OK. And we looked in many other species of nematodes. And what happened is that every species does it differently. Basically, the pattern is the same in all, but and it's completely amazing. I mean, each time we have surprises. So for example, Oshaius, my favorite other species, instead has the same final pattern, but instead of having a single wave of induction from the anchor cell, has two waves. And this is done by laser ablation of the anchor cell at different times. So we have a first induction inducing 5, 6, and 7 to a volvile phase versus non-volvile. And then you have a nested induction after one subdivision of the primary versus secondary phase. So it's another way of doing the same pattern. We don't know. So again, our big problem is that we cannot do any molecular genetics here. I mean, we cannot rule out that here P6P is actually different already from 5 and 7.
The second wave really means the second wave, or is it just continuous signaling?
We did so genetic screen on this, and there are mutants affecting the two at the same time. And if you put a MAP kinase inhibitor, it affects both. So probably it's the same signaling pathway being reduced twice.
There's no lateral signaling in that organism?
We don't know. Lateral signaling in C. elegans was found by mutant analysis. And we didn't find anything which would suggest this in Shays. More spectacular, and this is work from Ralph Sommer when he was a postdoc with Paul, in a species, so that's one of the species where the gonad has a single arm, and the vulva is actually very posterior. And the anchor cell is actually not close to the PNP cells when they develop. And if Ralph ablated the gonad very early on in this species, you had the perfect vulva forming. So you don't need an induction from the anchor cell here. So it becomes completely anchor cell independent. This is even more spectacular as a way of making the same pattern. Again, 4 and 8 are competent here, not 3. And from ablations of different PNP cells, Ralph could show that these cells are not equivalent, probably because they express different sets of Hox genes along the AP axis. You get all tertiary, all yellow. So this is a very schematic way of thinking of, how can you get this pattern? You can have a graded induction. You can have this sequential induction where the anchor cell induces P6P, which induces its neighbors. You can have the two-step inductions, like in Oshaius. You can have a pre-pattern of different Hox genes or whatever transcription factor, which is specific to each cell. You still need to understand upstream how it's regulated. You can have lateral inhibition, self-organization. It doesn't work with 5, but at least with 3, you can actually make a pattern of 3 cells. And it seems that if you take a given species, for example, C. elegans, you have 2 predominant mechanisms, or we don't know which one is predominant, actually. This one and this one. But you also have lateral inhibition, whereby the primary cell inhibits the primary fate in its neighbors. You also have pre-patterning, and this was found later, in the sense that P7P and P8P are less sensitive to being induced to a primary fate by expression of a posterior Hox gene. So you do have some contribution of this mechanism as well in C. elegans. And if you take another species, you might have this as a predominant mechanism, but many other mechanisms as well. So the image we get now looking at 20 species is that the mechanisms which make this pattern very extensively, whereas the pattern does not. And this one hypothesis is that because we see in a given species very often redundancy in the developmental mechanisms, this might help the evolutionary speed of evolution, of change. Redundancy might be selected for precision in a given species. It's not selected for evolution, for rapidity of evolution. But once you have redundancy, you might have changes in the weight, the relative weight of the different mechanisms at a relatively high rate. Those favoring rapid evolution of developmental mechanisms in the system. And I have an example within a species or a genus. It's actually a parthenogenetic species. It's difficult to define a species, but where very closely related strains differ in the requirement for gonadal induction versus pre-patterning by Hox genes in a continuous fashion. So our recent work has actually focused on what I call microevolutionary analysis of development, which is now not looking at comparing C. elegans or Chaius or this other nematode, but looking within a species. And one good reason for that for geneticists is that obviously if you see a phenotypic difference, you can genetically dissect it. And in hermaphroditic nematodes, what we study are genetically homogeneous populations, since in the lab they are completely selfing, so they are clones. So if we see variants, like this ACVU variant, this we can call developmental variants or noise. So what I'm going just to tell you in the last 10 minutes is the work we have been doing in the last couple of years on microevolution within C. elegans and within Ochaeus. And we then compare the two, but the work is done within one species. And the basically what I want to show you here rather rapidly is the comparison we can do between the effect of mutagenesis in a species and the observed change in nature looking at different strains, and the comparison between the effect in the lab of mutagenesis and what's actually found in the wild, and those unraveling what's the imprint of selection by the comparison. I hope it will be clearer later. So basically, if you do mutagenesis, you start from your original genotype of the strain you mutagenize, and you're looking just one gene around. And you're asking what type of phenotype are you going to find. So in C. elegans, this was performed particularly in Bob Horvitz's lab for vulva mutants. And you can screen very easily for vulva mutants because they don't lay their eggs. So the mother actually retains the eggs inside the uterus. They hatch, and this makes, the larvae are within the cuticle of the mother. So you have what we call bag of worms, which are easy to spot. And you can also see mutants with hyperinduction because you have additional bumps on the ventral cuticle. So there has been very extensive screens in C. elegans for vulva mutants. And in the lab, we did the same with Ochaeus, looking for the same phenotype at the dissecting scope level. But when we looked in the microscope, to our surprise, the spectrum of mutations was very different in the two species. So the Horvitz screen gave rise mostly, to mutants of the RAS pathway, which are either vulvaless if it's a loss of function of the pathway, or multivulva if it's a gain of function in the pathway. You have one locus, so notch, which is affected in the lateral signaling, and a few mutants which affect the competence of the cell. So, for example, the Hox gene.
Gain of function, you just get more cells converted to secondary phase?
Or primary. Actually, you get alternation of primary and secondary because of lateral inhibition. I didn't want to enter into details today because. and in Ochaeus, what we were looking for was to see whether we had mutants which genetically would distinguish the two inductive steps. And we found very, very few mutants of the induction. We found two enormous categories of mutants. One is affecting the divisions of the precursor cells downstream of their fate specification. And one is affecting, at the same time, the competence of the cell and the centering of the vulva. So we get a lot of mutants, for example, which don't don't exist in C. elegans, where maybe half of the cells are not competent and the vulva is centered on P5P. So overall, I mean, the details are not interesting for today, but overall, what's clear is that the two systems have different sensitivities to the perturbation of one gene, which we can represent in this manner. If we have the two species here with two different genotypes, which gives two different phenotypes, if you do a mutagenesis, in species one, you might have an elongated spectrum of phenotypes, and in C. elegans, that might be along the induction pathway axis. Whereas in species two, for example, Oshaius, this might be much more elongated along the division or competence centering.
So these mutations are all on one gene?
Yes, they're all single gene mutations.
Not the same gene, single
gene. But over what spectrum of genes were you?
So the C. elegans screens is was thought to be saturated. That's your question. And ours is definitely not, but already from what we have, we find a lot of mutations which were not found in C. elegans. So I think we can safely say. Excuse me? No, we don't know that. Yes.
Can you know anything about what the different mutations arise because of differences in vocal development or because different mutations are lethal for something completely different?
That's a good question. So in some cases, we found mutants which affect one vulval induction step and not the other, and you would say the mechanism is different. Or we found in Oshaius, P3P is not competent, and we found mutations which restore competence. So this is due to differences in the mechanism. Now, why didn't we find many mutations in the induction pathway? That might be due to the fact that they would be lethal and we missed them. So in terms of the mechanism, is less interesting. But for the point I want to make here is that in any case, during evolution, this would also operate. And by using this mutagenesis method, we can see what are the phenotypic states which can be reached easily, by one step from a given genotype, and irrespective of the reason, it doesn't actually matter. That's what I would define as the phenotypic neighborhood of a given genotype. And now, obviously, the next question is there any correlation between this phenotypic neighborhood that we assessed by mutagenesis and what can be found in the wild? So that was the work of another graduate student, Marie Delattre. So what we did was to take both in Oshaius and C. elegans, a lot of wild isolates. C. elegans is difficult to isolate, but Oshaius is very, very easy. So here what you do is you take genotypes which are relatively close together since it's the same species, and you're asking what are the phenotypes. And you also come with a general problem in nematode development evolution, is knowing that the cell lineage is globally invariant, how can it evolve given this constancy? We know that the vulva lineage of C. elegans and Oshaius are very different. I mean, the downstream lineage. And that's a general question in evolutionary biology, is the polymorphism within the species, do they have any evolutionary consequences in interspecies divergence? So I'm going to show you here the results only for Oshaius. In Oshaius, the vulva is formed by 5, 6, and 7 with this lineage. It's a very simple division pattern. And P4P and P8P divide twice, at least in our canonical strain. So we looked at different strains, and we have 30 of the species, and also at closely related species to see whether we get the same kind of variations between the species. And the outcome is mostly that this lineage here is invariant for the cells which actually form the vulva, with some exceptions I will tell you at the very end. But we get a lot of variations here. And this is shown here. Here, each one of these is one strain isolated from one part of the world. And each of them has two bars, for P4P and P8P with three color codes, either two divisions, and this is our reference train where you see that they divide twice. But you can have also a single division, and this is very common in this train, and that's actually very common in the eastern United States for some reason. And cases where you have no division of P4P. So you also have no correlation between the two cells. And if you go to closely related species, you see that you have fixation of some of these changes within Oceagus. So it's compatible with the idea that variations between sister species affect the characters that are actually polymorphic within species. Biological species mating. And also, I added molecular sequence identities. This closely related species, the closely related species, it's post-mating. And finally, I think one thing which was important in this study when we looked at thousands of animals in these different strains is we could start to ask, okay, P4P and P8P don't really participate to the vulva, so it might not matter very much what their cell division pattern is. They fuse to a big syncytium, which already has 50 nuclei. But what about the cells which actually form the vulva? So the central cells. And to our surprise, we found a lot of variations that we can start calling error, although that's completely anthropomorphic. So these are the numbers, which are rather high, about 1%, in Oceagus, where you have cases where you have one cell missing on one side or the other of the vulva. And this has to be compensated by, for example, here by P4P. Or you can have cases where the centering of the vulva is wrong on P5P or P7P. And this is actually a selection pressure for keeping a vulva competence group which is larger than three. So which was, in developmental biology, you could think, why do you express your Hox gene in these five cells to make them competent? You could also restrict it to three cells. This might be a evolutionary pressure to get a normal vulva. In the face of these mistakes. We also found some mistakes with two PNP missing on the same side. And in this case, this cannot be corrected because P9P is not competent. And some mistakes in the level of induction in Oceagus. And so I think this is rather important because in developmental biology, we never tend to actually assess how robust or how precise the system is. And this is a way of measuring it once more because we have this cell resolution level in nematodes. Now, the number in C. elegans, I don't know what it means, actually much lower.
The ones with the errors not corrected, so they don't form a vulva, but they're still viable and will produce offspring by bagging.
Yes, sure. This can still lay.
Well, it can still lay.
But probably not as many progeny. So,
are there wild species which don't lay the eggs but still?
Some do at some part of the life cycle when the mother gets old. She actually seems to sacrifice herself to feeding its progeny. We don't know anything about the population genetics and the ecology of these worms. But if you don't lay the eggs, you get about 50 progeny at most. If you do lay them, you get 300. So in an exponential type of proliferation, very, very fast, you would eliminate.
Well, unless there are ecological settings where the larvae are much more vulnerable, they inside.
Yes, yeah, no, sure. But you also have physiological regulation of egg laying. Okay, so basically, in C. elegans, we see some mistakes, but at rather low rate, whereas we saw that it was very easy to mutate the induction pathway here. So the comparison here between the high mutability and the robustness against developmental noise suggests that there is actually a strong negative selection on, a strong selection on having a vulva, which is intuitively obvious, but is nice to show. I mean, comparing this mutagenesis effect versus what we see in the wild is a way to demonstrate the imprint of selection. So that's my last slide, just to summarize the different levels of variations that we saw in these vulva developments. So for P4P and P8P in Oshayas, you have some developmental variance in a given environment. I didn't show you the data, but we also have variations with temperature, for example. And we can very easily find mutants for P4P and P8P of their division, which correlates with the wild variation. So we can say that this trait in Oshayas is absolutely not canalized against any of these three aggressions, developmental noise, environmental variations, and genetic variations. And actually, in the wild, we do find a lot of variations. So the character, this might evolve completely neutrally, or it might be driven by, you know, pleiotropic effect on some other trait, but we don't know. In C. elegans, P4P and P8P divide once, whatever happens. So this trait is extremely canalized. But if you look now at the vulva patterning in C. elegans, it's very robust to developmental noise or environmental noise. But it's not robust at all to genetic mutations. And we don't see variations in natural populations. And comparing these two, we can say that there is negative selection acting on this type of mutations in the wild. Okay, and these are the people who help doing the work.
Well, I have a nasty question. The one, the simpler one, is since you showed there are a variety of ways of making a vulva, why did evolution choose to do it in a variety of ways? But the deeper question, which is the title of your talk, The Evolution of Development, I remain a creationist in the following sense, that I'm prepared to offer a bottle of champagne to anybody that can give me a plausible story about how the evolution or how the development of the nematode evolved. Where did it come from? It's all right that you have this embryo with these things, but how did it evolve?
You mean in the pre-Precambrian?
Sorry, just give me a story of how you can get an embryo, an evolution of an embryo like a nematode.
It's not a scientific problem I want to think about.
No, that's why I'm a creationist. With only one bottle of champagne.
No, I agree with you. I'm not sure that.
But it's an important question.
It is a very important question, but I'm absolutely unable to answer this question.
I don't know why necessarily starting from an embryo that works entirely on a greater swamp, that would be a mechanism like progressive replacement. You can't get to something that changes the
stream.
I don't think that's the question.
I don't know how you get the embryo in the first place. It has any of these properties.
Any embryo.
No, any embryo I would give you. I can do that.
And what are the special properties for
it? I want to understand how it could evolve into something like this.
Meaning
what was the intermediate step?
But perhaps one can ask
what
in the process
what sorry
appeared to be so really quite
right. That's right. How did that evolve? Bottle of
champagne? I think you can find one case where you can prove there's no such topic, and then that would be easier because
I don't know.
And you can go to heaven.
But it seems that here that there is a smaller but perhaps answerable question that is posed, right? So how do you get these different mechanisms which conserve body fat? And in
not vastly different features, right?
Yes, that's the kind of question I've got to ask.
So maybe if you can understand that, you can you can move forward. But I'm really fascinated by it. Can one think that there is sort of one mechanism that does it, for example, signal, right? And then you sort of start generating, start breaking symmetry perhaps in your expression of Fox genes, which is actually a reinforcing signaling pattern.
Sure.
Right? So okay. Then you can create a signaling mechanism and you'll still have a.
Definitely.
Like, can you imagine that it is working on two legs?
Mm-hmm. That's the same with the lens induction in vertebrates, I think. It's
I mean, really nice in the story where you relay all these species and even which is up in the class of champion.
Yeah, you actually, for example, these inductive pathways in the vulva increase Hox gene expression. They actually refine Hox gene expression. So everything is Hox gene expression, but at the beginning some is just independent of the gonad and then becomes dependent temporarily in C. elegans. But in other species, it might become altogether completely independent.
How many known species are there?
I don't remember the number of described species, but it's... It's already much more than this, but the number of 100 million is one of... I mean, we don't know. It's
far more
I mean, if you think that every arthropod has a nematode parasite associated to it, then you.
And the ones, but the ones we had here are spread over the range of the family.
It's within one family or two or superfamilies. So it's a small part of the world diversity of nematodes. Yeah. These are living in the soil of bacteria. And,
And actually, the errors that you showed us are 1% errors that were you could see by eye, but then probably a lot of them through development were corrected by multiple pathways that came up within like a
process. Sure. So that's exactly what we want to work on now, is to actually see which of these pathways are actually used in different worms. I mean, different C. elegans. So all the nematodes we look at have more or less the same size at the... Yes, the enormous, like Ascaris is already 1 meter long or so. Probably most of the patterning is done with relatively few cells, and you have later proliferation in the adult, actually. So it doesn't require different cell specification mechanism. That have, sorry? Well, parthenogenesis, that you have embryology. What you mean is cutting, for example.
Asexually, I mean, not by other asexual modification.
Sure.
Rate of
them. No, sure. Aphids.
Extremely well.
Aphids. Or plants, or whatever. I mean, yeah, many.
Thank you very much. So, yeah. So